Houston, Manfred Eicher, and Gil Evans. For the first time in many years, his music will be performed in the Midwest with a world-class 13-piece ensemble led by Chicago trumpeter Chad McCulloch, along with trumpeter and saxophonist Jay Thomas. More information can be found at bluestemjazz.org. Blue Stem Jazz presents Chad McCulloch's Modal Horizons, the music of Jim Knapp, featuring Jay Thomas, on Friday, May 8th, 8 p.m. at the Burr Oak. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
Hello, this is Julie Kendler with the BBC News. There have been violent clashes at the University of California in Los Angeles between pro-Palestinian demonstrators and counter-protesters who attacked them. A group supporting Israel began dismantling barricades around a large pro-Palestinian encampment. Caroline Hawley reports.
On the campus of UCLA, the barricades around a pro-Palestinian encampment are torn down by counter-protesters after the university had declared it illegal. Footage posted online shows some masked demonstrators supporting Israel throwing objects into the camp. Tensions are high at many universities in the US. Pro-Palestinian protests, which began at Columbia University in New York, have now spread across the country. The protests have increased bitter divisions in the US about the war in Gaza, creating a headache not just for the universities, but also for the administration of Joe Biden.
Israel's opposition leader Yair Lapid has told the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken that Israel's Prime Minister has no excuse to not support a deal for the release of Israeli hostages. Benjamin Netanyahu has made clear that he opposes Hamas's demands for an end to the war and will go ahead with an offensive in Rafah, which the US opposes, Yoland Nell reports.
May 1st is a traditional day for protests, and Istanbul's famous Taksim Square has long been a focus for demonstrations of all kinds. So Turkish police weren't taking any chances. They'd blocked the square the day before, but demonstrators moved in to remove the barricades, leading to clashes with police there.
I'm sorry, that was the wrong report. We can now go to Yoland Nell's report in Israel.
As the top US diplomat met Israel's President Isaac Herzog, the families of Israeli hostages were demonstrating outside. Mr. Blinken went to greet them and said that setting their loved ones free was at the heart of everything we're trying to do. Mediators are awaiting a response from Hamas to the latest proposal. It's said to involve a 40-day ceasefire and the release of more than 30 Israeli hostages in exchange for many more Palestinian prisoners. A senior Hamas official has denied the group is to blame for delays on reaching a new deal.
Police in Istanbul have fired tear gas and rubber bullets to stop a banned May Day rally in Istanbul. Here's Paul Moss.
May 1st is a traditional day for protests, and Istanbul's famous Taksim Square has long been a focus for demonstrations of all kinds. So Turkish police weren't taking any chances. They'd blocked the square the day before, but demonstrators moved in to remove the barricades, leading to clashes with police there and in other areas of the city. Reports suggest at least 150 people have been arrested, but the leader of the country's main opposition party, the CHP, said they would keep on fighting until Taksim is free.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Are you a fan of classical music, especially early music? Do you enjoy hearing it on the radio?
WORT is now seeking a volunteer to join the hosts of Música Antigua, a long-running program highlighting the origins of classical music from the medieval era through the Renaissance and Baroque periods.
If you're free early Sunday mornings, we hope you will join us. Hosting a show on WORT includes choosing what to play, typing in your playlist, on-air announcing, and basic audio engineering.
You don't need radio experience, just a passion for this style of music and the willingness to work with us to increase and engage the many listeners and supporters in this show's early morning audience.
You can share your appreciation for this ageless art form by joining our 8 to 11 Sunday morning classical lineup. Volunteer applications are available at the station or online at wortfm.org.
WORT is an equal opportunity, affirmative action organization, and members of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply.
Support for this program comes from Orange Tree Imports, locally owned at 1721 Monroe Street in Madison for almost 50 years. Orange Tree Imports offers a wide array of gifts and kitchenware, including cookware, toys, specialty foods, and Wisconsin products. Information and store hours are available at orangetreeimports.com.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, May 1st, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Sarah Anderson, and Sarah Anderson is the Global Economy Project Director and co-editor of inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I wanted to talk with her about her recent post at inequality.org on the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The Congressional Progressive Caucus has released a sweeping Democratic agenda for 2025, and Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal says the focus of the new agenda is on a popular populist, and she says possible solutions that could become law in the short term if Democrats win a trifecta in November. So stay tuned to hear from Sarah Anderson. Also, I'll be speaking with Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, and wanted to talk with him about the Holtec International's public meeting 2 days ago with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and their submission to of documents to support the restart of the Palisades plant in Michigan. Beyond Nuclear has a lot of questions about what was submitted that they want answers to. So stay tuned to hear from Kevin Camps. And then later, I'll be speaking with Lisa Masri of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project. So at least 2 children have been killed in an overnight Israeli attack on a house in Rafa, while more reportedly died in an airstrike on a residential building in central Gaza City. UN Chief Antonio Guterres warns that an Israeli assault on Rafa would be an unbearable escalation that would be devastating for Palestinians in Gaza and the wider region. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israeli forces will enter Gaza's southern city of Rafah regardless of whether a ceasefire deal is reached. So stay tuned to hear from Lisa Masri from Madison Rafah Sister City Project. We'll be talking about the 24-hour protest encampment at the Library Mall, and you know, asking you university officials not to use police force against these peaceful protesters that are and to listen to their demands. We'll be talking about that. Also, a fundraiser to support the Middle East Children's Alliance this evening. So stay tuned to hear all of these guests. Stay tuned. I'll be right back.
Be a blind girl. some told me that it was over, babe.
About 11 minutes after 8, and joining me is Sarah Anderson, Global Economy Project Director and co-editor of inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies. I wanted to talk with her about her recent post at inequality.org about the Congressional Progressive Caucus agenda for 2025. And the caucus chair, Pramila Jayapal, says the focus of the new agenda is on popular, populist, and possible solutions. And that could be law, could become law in the short term if Democrats win a trifecta in November. So good morning, Sarah Anderson. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning to you. Thank you.
Hey, Sarah. You know, I really appreciate these pieces at inequality.org. And also the links that you have, and the link to the executive summary of the Congressional Progressive Caucus proposition agenda was actually just what I needed. It's really so hopeful. And so I appreciated being able to connect with that. But where I want to start is the growth of the Progressive Caucus, right? You've been following their work for some time, and it's grown, right? Even if it's still not a majority.
Absolutely. There are a little more than 100 members. I think it's around 103 now. And this is the House Congressional Progressive Caucus, but they also have one senator in there, Bernie Sanders, and he's sort of an honorary member because he was one of the founders back, I believe, in the 80s or early 90s. And so it has really grown and also become more structured, especially under the leadership of Pramila Jayapal, where they're able to act in certain instances more as a block to have a bigger influence on votes, especially bipartisan bills where they do have the numbers to block things if they don't get concessions that they're looking for.
And, you know, I talked to folks who are pretty fed up with Congress. They think nothing's being done. Why should they even be paying attention? But can you, you know, unpack that a little bit? And the Progressive Caucus has been able to flex its muscle, you say?
Absolutely. So there have been major pieces of legislation passed in the past few years, and the Progressive Caucus has had a big influence on them. So back in 2021, they were working on a bipartisan infrastructure bill, and two times the Progressive Caucus blocked votes because they were demanding concessions, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at the time wasn't super happy about that, but it did result in getting some better provisions, both in the infrastructure and bill and in the what became the Inflation Reduction Act, things like the pricing controls on pharmaceuticals and some better environmental provisions in the infrastructure bill. So they, you know, under Pramila Jayapal, she really flexed their muscle, irritated the leadership of her own party, but wound up getting some things that are good for progressives and the country as a whole.
And the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, which, you know, I didn't even, you know, there's some pretty good parts to that.
Oh, absolutely. And this money is just starting to roll out now, but I think people are going to be feeling it in nearly every community, particularly communities that have been underserved by public investment in infrastructure. So this is going to be tens of billions of dollars going into clean energy projects, into public transit, and, you know, other ways that, people are going to feel it. And there's also been a big push to make sure that the jobs that are created with all this public investment are good jobs. So with all of the large infrastructure projects, they're going to have project labor agreements that are bargained collectively between workers and their employers. And, yeah, there are a lot of good things in these bills that, people are going to be feeling more tangibly soon as the money starts rolling out.
So these new, there's about 100 or so members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Who are some of these new members and these new caucus leaders? And what are they bringing to Congress? Because there's some, you know, newly elected folks that have a lot of on-the-ground community organizing experience.
Absolutely. Well, Pramila Jayapal herself, I think we first met her when she was a community organizer and working a lot on immigration issues. And she was involved in a hunger strike on Capitol Hill. And we would go down and chat with those people. And she was one of them. And so she really comes out of movement organizing and strategizing. There's also a whole new crop. She's been in there for a while, but there's a whole new crop of leaders like Greg Kassar, who's a whip for the caucus, and he's, I believe, still a freshman member. But, you know, my colleagues knew him when he was helping to organize people living in mobile home parks. And so he's also got a long history of organizing in Texas before he entered the House. So, you know, there's Maxwell Frost, who I think is the youngest member of Congress out of Florida. There are many kind of rising stars in the Democratic Party who are taking on big roles in the Progressive Caucus.
No.
And I think, you know, that's one reason for their influence is these people come out of organizing work and they really appreciate the role that social movements outside government play in driving real change. And so I think, you know, in addition to their like willingness to stand up and block votes sometimes, they also flex their power by coordinating quite closely with groups outside government. And this 2025 agenda that I wrote about last week was really developed in close coordination with a lot of these grassroots campaigns because they know that that's where the real power is.
I wanted to highlight some of the agenda items. The whole thing is just so hopeful, and is only possible if, you know, I don't know if Pramila Jayapal, you called it the trifecta in November, but can you talk about healthcare inside of their agenda and housing? I want to start there with healthcare and housing.
Yeah, I mean, just to elaborate a little bit more on what you said, the caucus chair, Pramila Jayapal, does admit that a lot of this agenda would be hard to get through unless Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And that, of course, is a big if. But in her way of thinking, the way you motivate people is not out of, you know, fear and negativity, but by offering a positive vision of something that's really worth fighting for. And so some of the things that they lay out here are expanding the Medicare drug price controls that they got some of in the Inflation Reduction Act, but really to cover a much broader range of drugs that could lower prices for all Americans. They talk about expanding production of generic drugs. They talk about cracking down on the role of these private equity, like vulture firms in healthcare. People have probably been reading about these Wall Street firms that are taking over nursing homes and other parts of our healthcare system, and it's resulting in, you know, much poorer quality care in a lot of circumstances because they're really just interested in lowering costs and increasing their profits. And I think you asked about housing too. They put a number here. They talk about investing $250 billion to expand public housing and repairing existing public housing. They talk about ending homelessness by authorizing assistance programs. They talk about prohibiting landlords from discriminating against renters and trying to stabilize rents and cracking down again on the Wall Street companies that are buying up so much rental housing and just using it to, you know, to boost their bottom line by giving really poor, you know, quality, you know, upkeep, but raising rents on people. So that's what they start out with. They know that's what's on a lot of people's minds is the rising cost of living. And a lot of that has to do with healthcare costs and housing costs.
The let me just look on that section because I wanted to. Well, no, we'll keep going, and I encourage people to look at this document. And you can access their executive summary at inequality.org. I wanted to talk about the section on protecting the planet. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, and one thing I want to say is this agenda does focus on domestic issues primarily. They do admit that within the Progressive Caucus, they don't have a high degree of consensus on a lot of foreign policy issues, which is unfortunate. I mean, I think, you know, it's frustrating for a lot of people that this document does not address, you know, ceasefire in Gaza, does not address the military budget. Because they haven't been able to reach consensus on topics like that. But they do have a strong section on protecting our planet, which, of course, is a global issue. And, you know, some of the things they talk about is building on the Inflation Reduction Act, which we talked about earlier, which is going to plow tens of billions of dollars into things like public transit and clean energy transition, but really expanding those kinds of investments and doing it in a way that really strengthens community engagement. You know, one interesting part of the Inflation Reduction Act is this direct pay part of it, where your local church or your local school can get tax credits for clean energy products. Projects like putting solar panels on their roof. So it's really a fun kind of, you know, decentralized way of helping to accelerate the transition we need away from fossil fuels. They talk about ending all of the fossil fuel subsidies and taxing big oil's excess profits. On that one, I was thinking, I wonder, you know, I wonder what the Biden administration thinks about that. But actually, there has been talk within the administration about doing that as well. So there would be some support from the executive branch, too. And, you know, public transit is such a huge issue for low-income people, especially low-income people of color communities where people have trouble, you know, a big challenge of getting to work and getting to where they need to go if they don't have reliable you know, cars that they can use. And so, of course, a big cornerstone of their climate change agenda will be massive expansion in public transportation.
Now, I found the one of the sections that I wanted to talk with you about. It's on, it's section six, break corporations hold on our economy. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I am. Looking forward here.
This
is more the issues that I work on.
Yes,
and
yes.
So thanks for asking about this that I, you know, focus mostly on. And so fair taxes are high on their agenda. And what people need to know is that there's going to be a huge tax debate in 2025, no matter who wins the election at any level. And the reason for that is because when the Republicans passed their Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017, which was a huge giveaway to the wealthy and big corporations, a bunch of the tax cuts in there are going to expire in 2025. and it was set up that way from the beginning. And so this is really going to push a big debate over taxes. And not surprisingly, the Progressive Caucus is all about taking advantage of that moment to raise taxes on the wealthy and big corporations. They include some of Biden's favorite tax ideas, like a billionaire million minimum tax. And they also include one that I'm a big fan of that the administration hasn't been on board yet, and hopefully the caucus can push them on this. But that's the idea of taxing companies that have huge gaps between their CEO and their worker pay. This is an idea that's already happening in cities like Portland, Oregon, and San Francisco, California, where they're already raising revenue by putting a tax increase on companies that have these massive gaps. They're paying their CEOs hundreds of times more than they're paying their workers. And so it's a way to encourage companies to narrow those gaps. But if they don't, then they're raising some money on it that can be put into human needs. And I was really interested to see that the Progressive Caucus included that in their list as well.
The document just sort of represents, I think, the breadth of folks on the Congressional Black Caucus, a Congressional Progressive Caucus. So listeners, there's a section on labor, on advancing justice, reproductive rights, LGBTQ, policing reform, on a section on making democracy work. There's a section on education. Sarah, you know, I'm not sure if it was a link on your piece, but I did see, and I don't know if it wasn't, you may not know what I'm talking about, but I saw that yesterday the Congressional Progressive Caucus did meet, and they invited to their regular, I think it's a weekly meeting. Yeah, they meet weekly, and they met with National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. And so that difficult agenda that they haven't come out with a consensus document yet, I just wanted to add that they're not ignoring it.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that had happened. I know that individual members of the caucus have certainly been speaking out. And I think that the protests on campuses across the country has shifted the debate even more. I mean, and we had already seen quite an evolution since October until now, with more and more members coming out and calling for ceasefire. But I think the crisis on so many campuses has taken it to a whole nother level. And so I'm really glad that they're in dialogue with the administration on that.
Yeah, I think, as I do always with what I read at inequality.org, I think what happened was it sent me to the Congressional Progressive Caucus website, and it was posted there that they had met yesterday with Jake Sullivan. And so I just think that their work is, I mean, their intention speaks to wanting to come up with some kind of agreement beyond domestic policy.
Absolutely. And, you know, we haven't talked about that much, how much the caucus influences the executive branch. And I just want to lift up another example of that, which is on student debt cancellation, because so many members of the Progressive Caucus have just been hammering away at that for so long. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and Pramila Jayapal and many others have been on bills for years, you know, to reduce student debts. And they've just been they were really pushing the administration. And I know, people were disappointed that the really big plan to cancel student debts has been blocked by legal, obstacles. But the president has still found ways to relieve student debts for 4.3 million Americans. And I think just the doggedness of people in the Progressive Caucus is a huge reason why that has happened.
You know, as we're talking, this document, you know, is really a counterpoint, the opposite of the big document that was released on the other side of the aisle. What's the name of it? 2025.
The Heritage Foundation put out a 920-page document, which is their 2025 agenda. And it's funny you asked about that, because I did force myself to read the Labor Department section of that and other sections of it. We had a big conversation about it internally at IPS just yesterday. And their views couldn't be more diametrically opposed. You know, the Heritage Foundation is all about promoting sort of the idea that we should think of ourselves as individuals and about, you know, individual freedom instead of about supporting collective action to create together a better world. What I will say, though, that for people who might want to take a look at this Heritage Foundation document, it does reveal rifts within the conservative movement, and they're quite open about that. They will give, they'll say, you know, some of us support this, but there's an alternative view and others support that. And it was kind of fascinating to see how they are divided a lot as they struggle to be the party, you know, claiming to be for the working class, but also, of course, being a party that has a lot of influence by big corporations and then, a libertarian influence as well. They're open about those disagreements, and I will give them a little bit of credit for that. But overall, it really comes across as, a Christian. I mean, they're completely open about that. They talk about Judeo-Christian values throughout it and really, you know, using the rhetoric of individual freedom to push a lot of things that would just make poor people poor, and especially people, low-income people of color, because it's all about, you know, taking away in public investments and the responsible role of the government in making sure that our economy works for all of us.
I want to direct people to Sarah Anderson's post at inequality.org and at the on the Congressional Progressive Caucus 2025 agenda. From there, you can link to the executive summary, which describes the alternative to that view that Sarah was just describing. Sarah Anderson is the Global Economy Project Director and co-editor of inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Sarah, it's great to have you on this morning. Thank you for joining me.
That's great. And just to give a plug, if you do go to inequality.org, you can subscribe to our free weekly newsletter on the homepage as well. So great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Take care, Sarah. And I would highly recommend signing up for that newsletter. Hey, it's 8:33. Kevin Camps is standing by, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Enjoying the music, Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer. Hey, joining me is Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear. I think 2 days ago, the Holtec International held a public meeting with the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Staff, and submitted their quality assurance plan to support their request to restart the Palisades nuclear plant in Michigan. And I reached out to Kevin Camps, wanted to hear about what happened and about the packet of information that Holtec submitted. Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for joining me. You had a lot more questions than you got answers, right?
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Yeah, it was another painful meeting for concerned citizens. I mean, we did speak truth to power, but we were largely ignored, it would seem, and even worse than that. I mean, there's a lot of pro-nuclear trolls who come on these meetings now. They seem to be really feeling triumphant these days. So a lot of them are from around the country, you know, trying to influence local issues. But there are pro-nuclear voices from even Southwest Michigan, which is unfortunate. So we did our best. We certainly have a huge fight ahead of us.
So the packet of documents, had you been able to see some of that, or was that stuff you were trying to get from the Freedom of Information Act and had a hard time getting? What did they disclose? What did they say?
Well, what became very clear, and it has really been for 13 months now, is that both Holtec and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are making this up as they go. There's never been a reactor that closed that has been brought back into operation. So we've called it a zombie reactor ever since the idea was first floated by Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer back in April of 2022. So we've been at this for more than 2 years now. And so what was revealed at one important moment in the meeting was that Holtec had actually taken the wrong regulatory pathway on these quality assurance issues, and they were corrected repeatedly throughout the meeting by NRC quality assurance staff. And what I call this is the teacher helping the student pass the test. I know teachers are supposed to help students pass tests, but the students are supposed to take the tests on their own. And what this process that NRC does is it just gives the answers away to the company in this case. And, it's kind of frightening because quality assurance is so essential to safety. And actually, that's how I first learned about Holtec, was way back in the early 2000s, whistleblowers from industry and from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission brought to my attention quality assurance violations with Holtec's high-level radioactive waste storage containers that have never been corrected. And now here we go. This company that's never operated a reactor wants to restart a very dangerous one for the first time in history.
So for folks who aren't familiar with Palisades, and you say that a decommissioned power plant has never been restarted, talk about the problems there just in case folks aren't aware of what goes on.
Yeah, so Palisades was built beginning in 1967. They fired up in 1971, so they're well over 50 years old. They were a lemon to begin with. They had very troubled operations. Only a 50% production of electricity compared to what they were rated for and promised to do back in the 1970s. Lawsuits against the construction company for major construction errors. That was the beginning. But, you know, more recent times, after Fukushima, for example, in 2012, Palisades had five unplanned shutdowns in a single year, and they were at the very bottom of the safety rankings in the whole country. And they've got several pathways to meltdown. They have a lot of age-related degradation with the steam generators, the reactor vessel closure head. They have the worst embrittled reactor pressure vessel in the country, but the close second is Point Beach Unit 2 in Wisconsin. So that's a concerning thing that Lake Michigan is wedged between the two worst embrittled reactor pressure vessels in the whole country.
So we know that they have problems, but they also don't have to retain records. Can you talk about the record retention problem?
Yeah, that was one of our first alarms. I mean, we tried to stop Holtec from taking over Palisades in the first place, even when supposedly they were going to decommission it, which everybody thought was what was going to happen. Only what we didn't realize was we weren't distrusting Holtec enough. We distrusted them on the decommissioning, which is risky enough. Well, little did we know that a week after they took over at Palisades in June of 22, they applied to the U.S. Department of Energy for billions of dollars. We now have a count of up to $8.3 billion Holtec is seeking just for this restart scheme. And one of the first things that happened, even under the previous owner, Entergy, was they were ramping down to permanent closure, and they asked NRC for permission to start destroying documents. And the red flags went up instantly because Palisades has so many problems, and now those destroyed documents might shed a lot of light. So maybe behind the scenes, that's what they were planning to do, was to destroy the evidence. They say they can recreate the documents. Even if that's true, and we're very dubious, such inefficiency, and I mean such cost, and they're charging the public for all of this. So there was an NRC commissioner, Crowell, who back in February of 23 gave an interview, and he said, all of these folks who are for restarting this reactor, why did they wait till the last possible second to even say anything about it? So it's just, it makes no sense. But what's going on is Holtec and the U.S. federal government under the Biden administration, and the entire industry have drawn a line in the sand at Palisades and said, no more reactor closures. We're not going to let any more close. And in fact, they're pointing to it as what they call a shining talisman for the global nuclear industry, this very hyperbolic language. They want to start turning back on other closed reactors. So in Wisconsin, I'm still concerned about Kewaunee that closed about a decade or more ago. I'm still concerned that if the decommissioning hasn't actually progressed very far, that they may get this bad idea in their heads that they can restart it. And in fact, the decommissioning company up there, Energy Solutions, has already followed Holtec's lead in terms of proposing new build reactors. They're calling them small modular reactors on the Kewaunee site. It's in the initial stages of planning, but they floated that trial balloon. And that's a whole nother can of worms, but these reactors are not small. They're bigger than some past reactors have been. Past reactors like Fermi 1, where a meltdown took place in 1966, and we almost lost Detroit, or they're 4.5 times bigger than Big Rock Point, also on the Lake Michigan shore and northern lower peninsula. That was one of the dirtiest radioactive polluters in the entire industry, even though it was a relatively small reactor. Well, the new SMRs are 4.5 times bigger. And break-in phase risks, as they're learning the ropes with these new designs, operator and experienced design flaws, you can have brand new reactors have meltdowns. That's what happened at Three Mile Island Unit 2 in 1979, Chernobyl in 1986. So we're fighting, you know, zombie reactors, and we're fighting so-called new build small modular reactors.
The if greenlit, we're talking about a license that goes into 2050. What would happen in with that piece?
Yeah, that's going to be another major battlefront in all this. We fought the 20-year license extension. Palisades was originally licensed for 40 years. And then they started giving out these 20-year license extensions out to 60 years. And so we fought it hard at Palisades, raising all these issues and more. That was back around 20 years ago now. And we lost. They rubber stamped it. That took the license out to 2031. And now they want 20 more years. There's a growing number of reactors seeking these 80-year licenses in the country.
Got it.
And so they're really, you know, willing to press the envelope and continue to roll the dice on these age-related breakdowns. And the shutdown for 2 years now has actually made matters worse because they've not taken preventative steps or done active maintenance on these critical safety systems. So they have probably corroded at an accelerating rate because of their inaction on taking care of them.
So there's just so many pieces to this. The current piece, you know, being just some questions about the quality assurance process and what kind of documents and the NRC folks kind of feeding the answers to Holtec. And this idea that all of this is suspiciously appearing to look like this piece and the license renewal all behaving like it's a done deal, and people are kind of wondering about exactly what's going on behind the scenes. Am I being too anxious?
No. You know, for those of us who are following it closely, the writing is very much on the walls. I mean, you know, you had the energy secretary, Jennifer Granholm, the former governor and attorney general of Michigan, come to the Palisades nuclear power plant on March 27th to announce the first of many more bailouts to come. It was for $1.5 billion in so-called loans from the federal government. And then you had the governor of Michigan join her there. And then you've got the Nuclear Regulatory Commission chairman, who happens to be from the Palisades company town and gushes when he talks about Palisades. So it's just this real alignment at a very high level of the state and federal governments. And it's just crazy that they've chosen Palisades as their line in the sand to try to revive the industry, even including, you know, restarting closed reactors. This would be the first one, but they hope it'll lead to many more. There was just some reporting about that. But Palisades is so dangerous, and it's been such a lemon. And that's why it's just so ironic. But it's worse than ironic. It's incredibly dangerous. and it's insanely expensive. The public's paying for everything. I didn't mention the small modular reactors. That's another $7.4 billion for a grand total of at least $15.7 billion from taxpayers, both state and mostly federal. But also ratepayers are going to be paying a huge surcharge on their electricity. That's a part of this scam as well.
And yeah, tell us, who is Holtec and before then Entergy? Who are they?
Yeah, Holtec.
Are they experienced at doing this?
Holtec has never operated a reactor. They have never built a reactor. Their bread and butter since 1986 has been radioactive waste services. They build the containers. They don't build them very well. That quality assurance violation I mentioned before is a real risk across the country because there are thousands of Holtec containers loaded with high-level radioactive waste. They also did other services like racks in high-level radioactive waste storage pools, but their most recent chapter has been decommissioning. They really are the lead decommissioning company in the country, which is really scary because they're incredibly incompetent, or even worse. They've been misspending decommissioning trust funds, which should be a major scandal, but the NRC is barely even giving them a tap on the wrist for it. So what their business model appears to be is to seize the decommissioning trust funds, spend them on whatever is their agenda, and leave behind the radioactive contamination on the site for, you know, future leakage into the environment where it's going to cause harm to people downwind, downstream, up the food chain, and down the generations. That's their decommissioning model, it appears. And now, unfortunately for us, they've decided that they're going to build reactors and restart dead reactors and operate them. So it's a brave new world we're at the threshold of.
Thank you. Kevin Camps is radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear. Beyond Nuclear is a very distinguished group of experts, and their founding president was Dr. Helen Caldicott. Kevin, thank you for your update. You know, there's a lot more questions about Holtec's plans and that need to be answered. Thank you, Kevin Camps, for joining me
Thanks
this
so
morning.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's 8:47, and we're going to take a short break, and joining me will be Lisa Masri. I think is she standing by? Okay, we'll just hear a few little bits of music. Lisa Masri from the Madison Rafa Sister City Project will be joining me in a few moments.
Of you, be mean and you drive me away. Kind treatment make me love you.
So at least two children have been killed overnight in an overnight Israeli attack on a house in Rafah. And while more have reportedly died in an airstrike on a residential building in central Gaza City, United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres warns that an Israeli assault on Rafah would be an unbearable escalation that would be devastating for Palestinians in Gaza and the wider region. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israeli forces will enter Gaza's southern city of Rafah regardless of whether a ceasefire deal is reached. I wanted to talk with Lisa Masri from the Madison Rafah Sister City Project. Wanted to talk about the call to UW officials not to use police force against the peaceful protesters at the 24-hour protest encampment at the Library Mall, but also wanted to talk about, you know, their work to fundraise for the Middle East Children's Alliance and, you know, the serious concern and focus that needs to be put on you know, why the students are protesting and what is going on in Rafah. So good morning, and Gaza. Good morning, Lisa Masri. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So Lisa, I just wanted to get from you the concerns and any updates or about the 24-hour encampment. There's students out there protesting. Asking for listening to their demands. Can you tell us what's going on? What do you know?
Yeah, well, they set up on Monday morning after a rally, And there were hundreds and hundreds of people there. So it was really powerful. And they have their list of demands that they have publicized widely, mainly for UW system to disclose where their investments go and what specifically they're invested in, and then to divest from companies that support militarism and genocide. And the students can talk more about what their specific demands are. Over the past 2.5 days, they don't feel like they've had much response from the administration about their demands. They've had a lot of communication about what they are and are not allowed to do on campus and about protesting policies. And I think I've noticed that also in the media, they're really focused on, the protest policies and whether tents are allowed or not, without really focusing on what the demands are. Why are these students putting up tents against the protest policy supposedly at UW? And the police have come this morning and taken down the encampment. And you can get more on that. I was just there. And I know that a few people are arrested. Some people were detained. When I left to come get on online with you, there were still a couple tents up and people were surrounding it and chanting peacefully, again, about their demands. They want to keep the focus on disclosing, divesting, and on Palestine.
So there were hundreds of students out there earlier this week, but, the breaking news is that the UW officials and law enforcement have taken steps to dismantle the campsite. Just a few tents remaining. And, I was watching on the news this morning what was going around the country, and I hope that the message that they are the point they're trying to make isn't missed, right? I mean, this is unbearable, what is going on in Rafah and Gaza.
Yeah, and they're angry, and we've been working for months, and I mean, Madison Rafah and the SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, have been working for years on this issue, but very intensified our efforts in the past 7 or 8 months. And we're really just, it's like pulling teeth to get people to listen and take our issues seriously. And if you just watch the news speaks for itself. And even those small statistics you gave right at the beginning, those by themselves should speak for themselves. And those are one of 200, every day, every morning, it's like that. So.
Yes, the Madison Rafah Sister City Project had reached out asking people to call the university, the chancellor, the dean of students, the interim police chief, just to ask for not to use force in dealing with the protesters. Also to reach out to the governor and the mayor. And, I'm going to just, I'm looking at this message that I received. I'm just going to say that because, who knows? This isn't the end of it for sure. Folks are really horrified.
Yeah. And the university can authorize an encampment. We've seen lots of really positive responses from other universities across the U.S. On the other end, we've seen lots of very, very awful, violent responses. But in those positive responses, some people say, we're authorizing an encampment for, making an exception to this rule until the end of the semester, understanding that you have demands that you want to get out there and people want to come together and stand up for Palestine. And then once that kind of logistical barrier is out of the way, then a more free dialogue can be had between the administration and the students about the actual demands instead of about these policies of protest.
The characterization of these protests, I think, haven't been true that, I'm hearing about at the other places, other campuses, groups coming together, sharing together the celebration of holidays, that people are really coming together in peace, and that there may be some folks out there that are not associated with them who are doing otherwise. And it's that piece that's getting the news.
So
we really wanted to focus on, the truth about what was going on, and that I've been reading and hearing about reports of a whole lot of peaceful networking and across religion.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, the group did a Tatriz workshop, which is like a traditional Palestinian form of embroidery. And everyone got around and learned how to do this type of embroidery. There's been, you know, communal meals, teach-ins about different topics. And generally, if you go by the encampment, people are enjoying the sunshine, being there with their message in a very peaceful way.
Yeah, so be careful of what you're being told otherwise and discrediting what's happening out there. Now, tonight, or this 5 to 9, so this evening, there's a fundraiser for the Middle East Children's Alliance, a very reputable place to direct any kind of humanitarian contributions. Can you tell us about the fundraiser?
Yeah, so our group has organized something we kind of called Grassroots to Gaza, allowing people to just throw out their ideas about having different types of fundraisers. And fundraising specifically, we generally fundraise for the Middle East Children's Alliance. Their acronym is MECA, M-E-C-A, because they're really on the ground doing really great work. And so tonight we have an event, a music benefit and May Day pizza. And it starts, doors open at 4, music starts at 5, and there's suggested donations. And then there's a QR code, and there will be, you know, ability to donate at the location.
And where is this all happening?
This is at Giant Jones Brewing. Mm-hmm. And it's on our Facebook. If you look up Madison Rafah Sister City Project on Facebook or Instagram, it's at 931 Main Street in Madison.
The takeaway is to, you know, stay focused on what's happening. I think about 38,000 folks have, Palestinians have been killed, about 75 plus have been injured, and this peace-building effort by the Madison Rafah Sister City Project, the Grassroots to Gaza event, is a great way to focus, you know, your concern and funds going to the Middle East Children's Alliance. I'm just kind of floating away, Lisa Masri, with just thinking about all of this and the heavy force that has been taken to dismantle these camps, and I can't. I guess I'm just processing it live.
Mm-hmm.
But any other further news that you have about what's going on out there?
Well, I can't speak for the students, but they've had so much support and they've shown so much leadership, and they've just done a great job these past few days and all the days leading up to planning this. So I can't imagine that this is going to be the end. And we've seen around the country lots of instances where the encampment is taken down and then it's put back up, or it's put up in a different way. And so I hope that they know that the community is behind them. And you can always reach out to Madison Rafah Sister City Project if you want to support the students. We're very closely in communication with them about their plans and their efforts.
And, you know, check out these folks and these organizers. It's hard to, know who some of these other folks are that will be to come and we'll learn more about. But the folks at Madison Rafah and all these kids out there, are just trying to get the killing to stop.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, Madison, and there's also a chapter in UW-Milwaukee, also doing an amazing job.
Thank you. I'm speaking with Lisa Masri from the Madison Rafah Sister City Project. You know, check out their Facebook page to get details on the fundraiser and probably a place to go for any kind of breaking news on what's going on and organizing here in town around this issue. Thanks, Lisa. I'm glad we could talk this morning.
Thank you so much.
And hey, thank you, Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer this morning. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
And it's just about 9 o'clock. You're listening to WORT, 89.9 FM Madison, your listener-sponsored community radio station. Up next, Insurgent Radio Kiosk, and then we're going to go back to the country, so stay tuned for some really good music.
The This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, May 1st.
Can it be a crime to sleep in a city park at night when you have nowhere else to go? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. And that question was recently argued at the Supreme Court in a case that arose in Grants Pass, Oregon, which has some 600 unhoused people, no public homeless shelter, and an ordinance that first fines and after that issues trespass orders with criminal penalties for sleeping in the park. At the high court, lawyers for those persons facing criminal sanctions argued that they would be punished unconstitutionally for their status of being unhoused. They rely on a 1962 Supreme Court case that held that while a state could punish a person for possession, use, or distribution of a drug, punishing a person solely for their status of being drug dependent is cruel and unusual punishment. Likewise, the status of not having housing, they say, cannot be a crime. Also, it's hard to wrap your mind around how criminalizing not having a place to sleep makes any sense. Of course, the point is not necessarily to make them go to jail. The point is to make them go somewhere else. But, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked at oral argument, if every city, every village, every town passes a law identical to this, where are they supposed to sleep? A decision is expected by late June. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
De boule donne de la terre, de boule force de la faim.
Today is International Workers' Day, or May Day, and a march organized by the immigrants' rights group Voces de la Frontera is being held today in Milwaukee. And tomorrow, Thursday, May 2nd, a march organized largely by high school students will take place in Madison. Marchers are starting from both East High School and West High School and are expected to meet and rally at the Capitol at around 11:30 a.m. The group is demanding an end to the federal rule 287G and anti-immigrant measure that expands police presence wherever it is implemented. They also demand access to state driver's licenses for all residents, accessible education, universal free school lunch, and support for